I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
America's fascists are those people who think Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
What we've really seen is a financial sector that's gotten out of hand, has much too much of a role in this country.
What Putin is trying to do and what Trump is trying to do is undermine faith in our government.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans.
There's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy that people don't feel that they can do very much.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Well, tell me, baby.
In the era of COVID-19, what happens to America's seemingly never-ending wars across the globe? Virtually every facet of the American economy is impacted substantially from the deadly pandemic, and social distancing remains essential. Certainly the Pentagon isn't immune from all this. They're people, too. Great American Navy ships have become petri dishes, pandemic hot zones. Is coronavirus now more of a threat to our military personnel? Quite possibly. But of course, the towers of money that fuel the military will not be perturbed. There are lots of other ways to spend cash on killing people, especially brown and black people in distant lands. And in this corona era, in the massive wake at the anger and murder of George Floyd, perhaps military drones and robots may prove to be of use right here in the streets of America. Welcome to the 2020s. Our returning guest is retired U.S. Army Major Danny Searson, whose recent article on Tom Dispatch is titled "The Coming of a Social Distancing Version of War, The Future of Forever War, American Style." His new book, Patriotic Descent, America in the Age of Endless War, will be published this fall. Danny Searson is a former history instructor at West Point and served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Thanks so much for being back with us, Danny.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm glad to do it.
The article opens with these possibly optimistic words: COVID-19, an ongoing global human tragedy, may have at least one silver lining. It has led millions of people to question America's most malignant policies at home and abroad. How and why might that happen? How did COVID-19 play into people waking up to that?
Well, you know, one of the things about the virus is that if it has a silver lining, as you mentioned, it is this sort of exposure of the systemic rot of empire. And so folks have started to ask important questions that many of us, right, have been sort of feeling as though we're shouting into the dark for many years,
right.
You longer than me. And that
That's
is, where should this Pentagon money have been spent? You know, how much better could it have been used to buck up the economic backstop, right, of a safety net when something like this happens, or even just direct funding to the CDC and all these other things? And of course, we just pulled out of the World Health Organization. And so there are questions being raised about what we get for empire.
Mm.
And then, of course, what are the opportunity costs for empire? And the short answer, of course, is we get nothing from empire. It's all cost, right? And the juice is not worth the squeeze, right? All risk, no reward. And then the fact of the matter is, what's the opportunity cost? We found out in a very real way what has been somewhat hidden, because we don't have a draft, we don't have a direct war tax. And what we found out is that the opportunity cost is potentially lethal in a very literal sense.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you know, sort of fiddling while Rome burns, as they say. And, you know, as you say, you know, what is the old bang for the buck, the cost versus benefit? Not a lot of benefit, very high costs. And, of course, coronavirus is bad here in America, but in many parts of Africa, it's actually much worse because people don't have options of social distancing. One place you mention is Somalia. COVID-19 is, as Tom Engelhart writes, is tearing a path of death through that country's capital, Mogadishu. And since the disease has until recently been the only news story, Somalia is nowhere on the news these days. Tell us, what is America's military's role there?
Well, ostensibly, it's to fight an Al-Qaeda-aligned, in a mostly symbolic way, of course, Al-Shabaab terrorist group, as we call them. And so this is an Islamist group. It literally means the youth. And that's who we're fighting. There's two important things to understand about the war in Somalia. Number one is the historical context and how we've largely created the problem we're now ineffectively trying to solve. And of course, we've been at war actually in Somalia now for 19 years almost. And then the second one is that we've actually, in a fit of pandemic opportunism of Trump and Pompeo and company, we've actually escalated that war exponentially and no one's talking about it. So let's start with the context. If anyone knows anything about America's role in Somalia, it's probably the movie Black Hawk Down from 2001,
right,
which heroicizes sort of the what was a heroic fight of Army Rangers, 18 of whom were killed, two Black Hawks were shot down, and all this, right? And that's always taken out of context. There's no politics in the movie. There's no context. And that movie was actually screened for all of us cadets at West Point in 2001 when I first got there. Fascinating, actually. But the reality is that the United States created, in many ways, al-Shabaab and, at the very least, empowered them. How did we do that? Well, after 9/11, we immediately associated Somalia, because of its Muslim population and its strategic position on the Red Sea and the Horn of Africa, as a threat. And we didn't really find much al-Qaeda there, so we had to invent some. And then after we started inventing some, we actually legitimately created some, and then we had something to fight. The way that we empowered al-Shabaab, the current enemy, right, which really has very local aspirations for the most part outside of some rhetoric, is that we backed a proxy, the American way of war, long been the American way of war, even more so now. We said to the Ethiopian, largely Christian and somewhat rightist regime, we said, why don't you invade Somalia to throw out this relatively moderate and quite popular Islamic courts union, and we'll support you with drones and satellite imagery and special forces. And they did, and they invaded, and they occupied the country, and it was actually very bloody for Ethiopia, became known as their Vietnam, right? Ethiopia's Vietnam. Well, what did that, you know, to keep it brief, what did that do? Well, the Islamic Courts Union was sort of destroyed and went into hiding, and their more militant youth movement, after we cut the head of the snake off, rose like a phoenix and became even more extreme, and we've been fighting them ever since. There has been no victory. It has been counterproductive and empowered al-Shabaab. And, of course, the real cost, as always, is on the Somali people, hundreds of thousands of whom are now living in refugee camps. And as you know, these are not great places to live in the midst of a pandemic.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. Not a great policy. We never seem to learn. But, you know, at least there's money being made, and we're not hearing about it. It's not in our face. So, oh, what the heck? You know, it's Trump has complained in the past about, his words, ridiculous, endless wars. He flip-flops all over the place, though. You never know from day to day. You refer to macabre, largely under-the-radar pandemic opportunism. You just talked a bit about Somalia. What about Iraq, Iran, and even Venezuela? How is this under-the-radar pandemic opportunism?
Well, the thing about Trump is that if you listen to him long enough, if you can stomach it, he's going to say something true against his better instincts. And in his inaugural or his last State of the Union, he said that great nations don't fight endless wars. And I thought that was excellent, except what he should have added was ... they get others to do it for them.
Yeah.
And others means machines, militias, and mercenaries. And so what have we seen? Well, beginning with the machines, we've seen the escalation, pandemic opportunism, that I call it, of the wars in places, you know, like Somalia. There's been orders given to the senior American general in Iraq to prepare for like a real, more escalated proxy war with Iran. Pompeo has been reported to have, widely reported to have encouraged Trump to bomb Iran itself during the early stages of the quarantine and the pandemic.
Sure.
The strangulation of Iran and other countries that we call enemies with sanctions, and a refusal to heed the begging and the pleading, and it must be seen as that, of not only the UN Secretary General, but also every major international humanitarian organization, as well as our NATO allies, who have called for a global ceasefire and a global freeze to sanctions. And then the final thing is the mercenaries, right, and the proxies. And this is what we're seeing in the midst of a pandemic. suddenly Venezuela is an existential threat again. So much so that we have to send warships in their direction, talk about potentially blockading them, and even, and this is my favorite thing about Trump, man, is he is so raw and honest in some ways about his militarism, and that is vigilante bounty hunter foreign policy. We put a $15 million bounty on the head of President Maduro in Venezuela, and then we acted surprised and washed our hands of the American Green Beret veteran mercenaries who tried to overthrow him in a farcical, you know, Bay of Pigs type coup. Well, I don't know. I'm not a mercenary, but I've watched enough Clint Eastwood movies to know that if you put a $15 million bounty on someone's head, folks is going to try to collect it. This is obscene, is what this is.
Oh, amazing. Absolutely amazing. The deeper you look into this stuff, the weirder it gets. Now, given the spread of the pandemic in these countries, Somalia, Iraq, Iran, Venezuela, you know, all over the place, how is U.S. military policy affecting public opinion there and support for our policies? Do we know if it's had an effect on, you know, if the pandemic has had an effect on how the people locally feel? They probably didn't feel too good in the beginning, I must say.
Yes, I mean, there is some data and many analytical articles to indicate that, you know, America's legitimacy has, you know, shrunk even further into the basement. You know, we'd already been, you know, sent down to the minor leagues, you know, probably in the 1980s, and now we can barely play summer A-ball. Before the pandemic, global polls showed that the United States was seen as the greatest threat to security and human rights in the world. Not China, not Russia, not Iran, not Venezuela. You know, whether or not that is completely appropriate, I think it largely is. The fact that that was the opinion even before the pandemic is itself instructive, right? And then, of course, Israel is usually number two as the second greatest threat. What we know for sure is that strangulation sanctions in the midst of a pandemic, escalatory rhetoric and action has, let's just take Iran, had the effect, as it always does, of rallying the people around the flag of even an oppressive regime. This has always been the case. We seem never to learn. It almost makes you want to be conspiratorial and wonder if the goal was to empower these hardliners so we then could bomb them. Because the youth in a place like Iran, we've seen when they're left alone long enough, actually is not particularly fond of the Ayatollahs.
Right.
And yet, if you act the part of the great Satan, as we have through lack of empathy and decency, then the government in Tehran is able to say, look, all of your problems are from the United States,
sure,
not from our mismanagement, even though the real truth is it's both. And so we empower the hardliners, and it's counterproductive, and just like pulling out of the nuclear deal was. So look, legitimacy matters. Soft power matters. You need alliances, and you cannot build enough tanks, and you cannot build enough aircraft carriers to win back your sort of ethical legitimacy and your strategic legitimacy once you've lost it. And we lost it long ago, and now it's just gone to a farcical level.
Oh, my goodness. It certainly has. We're still going there. For those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. We are keeping democracy alive. Our guest today is Danny Sjursson, who is a U.S. Army major, retired, former history instructor at West Point, served in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're talking about an article he wrote in Tom Dispatch, The Coming of a Social Distancing Version of War, The Future of Forever War, American Style. And, Cuba is an example, obviously. It's just too obvious. You know, whether or not the people liked Castro, there was the great Satan to the north. What could be better to unite the people there? Well, you don't exactly predict, but you do raise the possibility, quote, the spread of COVID-19 has offered a rare opportunity to raise questions, to challenge frameworks of these endless wars. Say a little bit more, please.
Well, again, the thing to understand is if it's been proven that we're not winning, that we're largely counterproductive in our, you know, imperial adventures, and if it has been proven that the opportunity costs are huge, some folks who otherwise don't pay a whole lot of attention to the Pentagon budget or to wars, and I'm not talking about the Democrats in Congress who rubber stamp it, although they are having a little bit of a come to Jesus, although it won't last, about fucking common citizens who don't give much thought to the military except at the halftime show, because there's no draft. And they're starting to question what is the utility, what is the cost benefit of these wars. Now, I think the point of my article, and you know, we'll go in the direction you want on that, is that I don't suspect, given my historical understanding, that the powers that be, the security state and the military-industrial complex, is going to cede the narrative to us. Instead, I predict, and predictions are tricky, but I think I'm going to be right. Unfortunately, I hope I'm wrong, Bert, but I think what's going to happen is we'll see an evolution of war to really such a distant and abstract machine and mercenary-based level that what they'll do is they'll make it so distant from what we think of as war in a traditional sense that hopefully the people will, it'll become invisible and they'll pay even less attention. So I see evolution rather than ending. In fact, I think ending wars may turn out to be a matter of semantics alone.
Well, like we've seen so many times, I remember in Vietnam when, you know, we got fewer boots on the ground. That's what Nixon cared about. But the war went on and there were fewer deaths. So that's all, fewer American deaths. So that's what people cared about. And, you know, interesting how the technology that exists there now, mixed with the COVID-19 realities of, you know, trying to protect people, gives a new framework for different kind of endless wars and keeping them invisible. That's what you have to do, obviously. Now, it seems the Pentagon and mainly Republicans in Congress have been keeping their head down no matter what lunacy Trump offers. Of course, I wish more Democrats would speak out too, but they get their money from the same place oftentimes. However, Secretary of Defense Mark Esper announced plans for a modest troop drawdown in parts of Africa. I wonder if you could tell us about Chicken Hawk Lindsey Graham's reaction to that.
This was one of those, quite frankly, absurd moments that should not be dismissed, actually, should be looked at very closely. Anecdotally, what happened is that Esper had announced, really just days before this all went down, this is right at the cusp of Corona hitting, that he was going to pull some troops out of AFRICOM, right, out of the continent of Africa.
Right.
And the reality is it was a modest withdrawal, and it was a lot more like retrenchment, right? So he was kind of, and he even, you know, Esper even defended himself by saying, look, we're really just shifting folks around and we're, you know, focusing on priorities, we're reprioritizing. And of course, all these wars in Africa are failing, counterproductive, and actually catalyzing more conflict locally. But what happened is Lindsey Graham and then a bipartisan group of hawks in Congress got together. And he was, of course, the cheerleader. Lindsey is always the cheerleader. He's working double time to fight for the spirit of his old buddy McCain. And so he actually flies over to either Munich or some other city in Germany where there's like a NATO security conference, and he confronts Esper to his face, and he says, quote, something to the effect of, you know, if you pull the troops out of Africa, even this modest withdrawal and retrenchment, I can make your life a living hell. And of course, Lindsey is correct about that, because he has a lot of power in his foreign policy portfolio over the years. The Congress does not take a stand on ending or beginning these wars or declaring them, but it does control purse strings and a bureaucratic mechanism that can make someone like Esper's life very difficult. So what does this tell us? Well, it tells us two things, I think. The first is that there are pecuniary and professional advancement issues that are driving the system to want more war, more adventure, more reason to spend money and fund special forces and all their toys. But I also think, and this is important, that ideology matters, and we shouldn't dismiss it out of hand with pure economic determinism, although I think that's usually the core focus. People like Graham have been in this game so long of exceptionalism, militarism, and then thus adventurism and chauvinism that I think that they really truly believe their own mythology of we're the indispensable nation. We're the only thing that's standing between us and the barbarians at the gates. And if we pull even modestly out of Africa, then, you know, the People's Army of China is going to come in. And, you know, so this narrative has been proven wrong time and again, you know, ever since the Cold War started. And yet it persists. And I think some of these folks, maybe they didn't start out really believing, maybe they opportunists, but I think that, you know, you form habits of mind and you begin to believe your own lies. Everyone has a family member where they've seen that, right?
Yes, unfortunately. Well, you know, when you start, it's easy to believe the lies if they get told often enough, especially the person who's telling it even. And getting down to nuts and bolts here, you know, the infantry, people who was, you know, literal boots on the ground, that's going to be less of a factor in the COVID-19 and post-COVID-19 age. And you write that the disease will surely have some effect, just as quarantine and social distancing measures have transformed people's lives and work in the U.S., Washington's warfighting will undoubtedly have to adapt too. So adding COVID-19 to the reality of these endless wars, what are the effects we might expect? What will social distancing style warfare look like?
You know, for a couple of reasons, one being the health crisis and the CDC guidelines on social distancing that I think are with us to stay to some extent, as well as this idea of trying to keep casualties low and thus the wars out of the media, the methods will change. And so this is an evolving process that's really been going on since maybe the middle of the second Obama term, when large-scale occupations and boots on the ground, folks like me, infantry and sort of scouts and all that, we're kind of becoming a little bit obsolete, at least in the shooting wars. And so just as a point of reference, ancient history, I know for most of the folks in America, and maybe not your listeners, Bert, but in 2007 and then, you know, during the Iraq surge, which I was in, and then 2009 through 12, the Afghan surge, which I was also lucky enough to get to join, the main game in town was the conventional army. So we had about 40-ish brigades in the army at the time, and at any one time, literally half of those brigades of us were deployed. And then the other half were preparing to deploy and knew exactly where they were going. And so that was the main game in town. And special forces were important, but they were the minority. Now you can count on one hand the number of brigades deployed in actual shooting wars. And most of them are only there as advisors, kind of like a skeleton crew. Most of the soldiers stay home and the leaders go. Instead, the special forces, who've been expanded so far up to about 70,000 that they raise serious questions about how special they are anymore, have taken on the larger part of the burden. And so this is the new system. And so the building blocks down at the, you know, nuts and bolts level that you mentioned are going to be very social distancing friendly. So you'll have drone teams, which can do their job in two-man elements in a trailer, often in the deserts outside Las Vegas, flying over Pakistan or whatever. That's pretty good social distancing. And then the main building block, of course, of the American way of war moving forward, and it'll already is the Special Forces A-Team, and that's a 12-man specialty team that sort of trains and advises either militias or government forces. And so, you know, that's only two people above the 10-person or less what used to be the CDC guidelines. So, you know, this is just exemplary and anecdotal, but I think it shows us the way we're going to turn war into an abstract. Machines, mercenaries, militias. I like my alliteration.
True, indeed. And, I'm thinking about President Obama. He used drones a lot. There were a lot of effects of his using. I mean, he also wanted to have wars that people didn't notice so much, that wasn't dominating the news like Vietnam used to. And drones have been there for a while. And I wonder about real threats to America. I would think wars on computers, cyber war, would be something that is far more of a threat if anybody's going to threaten us. Are we protecting ourselves from that kind of stuff, or is this just superfluous?
Well, I see four actual national security threats, like really serious national security threats to the United States. And what I'll say is that the military as constructed is impotent to face really any of them. And so in order of severity and immediacy, we have nuclear annihilation, probably set off if it occurs by some sort of accident or misunderstanding with the Russians or the Chinese or whomever else, probably partially provoked by our military being right up on the borders, for example, of Russia and the old Soviet republics, or in the South China Sea, which I think an important part of that sea's name is that it has China in it. Basically, they're Caribbean, but we think it's an American lake. We treat it like Lake Erie, but it's pretty close to China. The second threat, of course, is climate change, which is probably even greater, but is slightly less immediate, although increasingly immediate. No amount of aircraft carriers and tanks is going to affect that. In fact, it's going to only make it worse. This is the DOD is like the largest polluter. And then I think the third one, of course, is pandemic and health crisis. And we've seen that if anything, the military becomes even more vulnerable to it and can do very little except some of our comfort ships, which can provide some medical aid. But overall, the Army infantry brigades are not very helpful against a virus. And then finally, you mentioned sort of cyber, which could potentially shut down elements of our economy or essential services. And again, the military is starting to develop a cyber command. But, it's still not the focus. And often it's used for offensive operations as much as defensive. And of course, that's problematic. So, we've got a military design for threats that don't exist. And so we have a military that does two things. We have a military that prepares for wars we can't fight, meaning putting ground troops and brigades as we have in Europe, right up on the borders of the Soviet Union. You can't fight that war. It would end the human race, right? Nuclear winter. You can't fight a war with Russia. So we prepare and we train for wars we can't fight, and then we fight brush fire wars from West Africa to Central Asia that we can't win. That's the reality of the American military. Totally farcical.
Wow. And you say, it might be a version of war so unrecognizable that while still unending, it may no longer pass for war in the classic sense. So people will, once COVID-19 ends, we'll be at peace, right? Except we won't be, because they'll be done remotely. And there's always the option of redirecting defense expenditures to investing in policies and programs that might actually win hearts and minds of people in the now war-ravaged areas. You write that, quote, rather than rethink the efficacy of imperial interventionism, Washington simply substituted new methods masquerading as the latest strategy of success. Please explain what you mean here.
Yeah, so what we've done is rather than actually have the come to Jesus, moment that you would think the rapture crowd like Pompeo and Pence would be about, instead of that, we have, we're not going to question the ethics or the efficacy of imperial adventure. We're just going to find new ways to do it that don't raise the public ire. Uh-huh. This has been the case ever since Nixon got rid of the draft, which was a very cynical move to stop the anti-war protests. We actually have the transcripts declassified, right? We know why he did it. He didn't do it because he's a nice fellow. So what we're then seeing in today's wars is a learning, evolving, and rather savvy security state. And it realized that even with even the flag-draped caskets of volunteer soldiers, if they come home in large enough numbers, they do raise the public ire and have some limited political cost. And so the goal is eventually, I think the logical outcome, the logical goal extreme of this policy is to continue to kill thousands and thousands of brown folks in foreign countries and wars we can't win, but to do so without losing a single American soldier. And I think in my lifetime, that may happen. And there's something obscene about that, as I wrote on Memorial Day. And the final point is, we're recording this segment on D-Day, of 2020. And the point is, America's way of war today looks nothing like D-Day. And yet the popular civilian imagination is trapped in the Saving Private Ryan version. Mm. So that's no longer valid. Although if you're a Yemeni child and a bomb's falling on your head, it still feels a lot like war, just not here in the States.
Good points. And you mentioned that it's D-Day as we're being recorded today. A previous guest on the show on Memorial Day, Eric Edstrom, who I believe you know, served in Afghanistan in 2009. He's the author of a new book, Un-American, A Soldier's Reckoning of Our Longest War. He described an average American awareness of our service members' lives as like chicken McNuggets. What he meant is that all we see is neatly packaged, sanitized, wholesome products. Or in your words, policymakers and the public alike may treat war with the same degree of entitlement and abstraction as ordering items from Amazon, especially during a pandemic. So this is a click of a button, you expect a package at the door, very neat, and it's translated into war making in the future.
Like the title of his book, Eric is a friend and a colleague, great writer, phenomenal writer. And with the Amazon thing, my idea is look, we sort of expect outcomes from our military that might be unrealistic. We only think of them on, you know, Veterans Day, Memorial Day, or maybe during the halftime show of an NFL game when that's allowed. We don't do a lot of thinking about what it actually takes to uproot a soldier from his home and his family, send him overseas, you know, the logistics of it, the ethics of it, the strategy of it, and then what he's actually doing, right? What are the outcomes in terms of on people, civilians, and enemies, but then also sort of what are the outcomes in terms of are we having any effects? So that we don't like to deal with the complexity. It's much easier to sort of like wrap ourselves in the flag or say we're going to, you know, support the troops with it, whatever, like the platitude of the bumper sticker. But there's not a lot of thought given to what American war actually looks like. Memorial Day was a perfect example of that. And me and Matt Ho, a Marine Corps veteran of Iraq and then State Department veteran and whistleblower of Afghanistan, we argued in Mother Jones sort of that, hey, like, maybe Memorial Day is obsolete, and we meant to be provocative, but what we were saying is we should think less about D-Day, because, you know, those folks are mostly dying off, not that we shouldn't, you know, recognize them. Both my grandfathers were in the military in World War II, but, you know, there's something really deeply dark and disturbing about, you know, memorializing war where hundreds of thousands of enemy die, and we lose a handful of folks, so few that we can even laud them at individually at State of Union addresses. I mean, there's something really gross about this, and I think problematic ethically and constitutionally.
Yeah, but it just, I don't know, it seems to be part of our identity. And we mentioned, you know, there's the big stuff. Russia and China are always, you know, the big bad guys. Although it seems odd with Russia these days, and, you know, pushing the NATO into Poland seems to, you know, be sort of a stick in the eye to Russia. And China, we got our guys out in the South China Sea. Russia and China are both, you know, good reasons for increased Pentagon spending. How might seeing our stealthy policies in the former Soviet republics and in the Pacific near China, how might they see it as provocative?
Well, I mean, just to, you know, coin a cheeky term, I mean, I've been saying recently that the American way of war now is to prepare for wars we can't fight and fight wars we can't win. And what I mean by that is prepare for wars we can't fight. Now, we could, it would be a disaster, but you really can't fight an outright war with Russia or China without an existential threat to the planet. Doesn't mean we won't, we haven't so far, but prepare for wars you can't fight, be provocative, send yourselves in there, right up to their borders, I'll get back to that, and then fight wars, right, these brushfire wars around the greater Middle East that you can't possibly win, right? They're unwinnable, they go on forever, the outcomes are actually kind of productive. But why is it provocative? Well, I mean, look, whatever one thinks of Beijing, whatever one thinks of their policies towards the Uyghurs, these are all complex issues, and I'm not a particular fan of any authoritarian state. However, there is a key factor here, and it's not a straw man. It's called the South China Sea, and it has the C word in it, right? It is, in many cases, their Caribbean. That does not mean that I want these, you know, a bunch of dominoes to fall or all these other allied countries of ours in the region to, like, fall under the sway of China. First of all, I don't think that's really their intent. Second of all, I don't think it's within their capacity. But finally, I think it is important to recognize that a rising, you know, state economically and militarily like China is probably going to expect to have a degree of influence in the sea named after them as we might expect to have, you know, off the coast of the Atlantic or in the Caribbean. So there's this sort of a hypocrisy there. For Russia, I've talked about it over and over again, and I just feel like I'm beating my head against the wall. You know, we broke every verbal agreement that George H.W. Bush, the better, although largely wildly imperfect Bush, mm-hmm. Bush the elder, all the deals that were made, right? James Baker has talked about this, Scowcroft. I mean, all the deals made to Gorbachev where he basically begged us not to dance on the Soviet grave or it would hurt all of us, which it has. Mm-hmm. We've expanded NATO right up to their borders. We have troops stationed miles from their border in former Soviet states. And no one asked the question, would we or should we fight a full-scale and potentially nuclear war over Latvia? No one asked that question. I wasn't asked. I didn't get to vote on it. You know, these are decisions that are largely made executive or very distantly by elected representatives in a most tangential sense. This is we are being brought to the brink of potentially existential war without the American people really being asked about it. And that is wildly provocative domestically. And then also, if you take the view, as we always should try, from Moscow or Beijing.
And there was something in the Constitution about war-making powers. Our founders wrote up some pretty good documents, and one of them was requiring that basically a king can't make war, that in the United States of America, war can only be declared by Congress. Of course, the word declare is key here. Well, they can do lots of other things that are not declaring war. But does it help our national security? Boy, I don't think so. And there's just all these, I mean, there's smaller wars all over the place. And we, you know, there were those four guys that got killed in Niger, I think it was, brush fire conflicts. How do they do it in the COVID-19 era? Do they just blow it off and, you know, forget that it's there? How does it affect these smaller wars, these brush fire conflicts?
Well, you know, the point about Congress is important. The Constitution is written, it's supposed to be hard to go to war.
Yes.
Right? Anytime you put something in the hands of the legislature, like democracy in general, is messy, to steal an out-of-context quote from Rumsfeld, right?
Yes.
So anything that happens in Congress, especially in the House of Representatives, is messy and contested. And they put war-making declaration authority there for a reason. Also,
very
they put funding of the military on sort of an annual basis. They are for a reason. It's supposed to be hard. We've gotten around that. We've only declared war, I believe, 5 times in American history. And yet we've been at war almost every year of our existence.
Yeah.
One of the ways that that's been done, of course, is there's two. One is you get Congress occasionally to have an authorization for military force, right? Like we did for Iraq and like we did for Afghanistan. Now, the beauty of those is that they stand in with all the advantages to the president of a declaration of war. He looks like he went to Congress, but Congress can say they didn't really declare war. And then once it's in place, it stays in place unendingly, you know, 19 years and 16 years, you know, respectively for the two AUMFs, and they just get stretched. And so you can actually throw any war under the original AUMF, even if it doesn't match. And so, but the key thing here is Congress doesn't want to declare war. They don't want to put their name to paper taking a stand on war, because if and when they go bad, it can hurt them politically. And they learn the lessons of the Federalists and the Whigs, who were discredited and abused for their opposition to the War of 1812 and the Mexican-American War, and actually almost went extinct as parties. And I think the Democrats learned the same lesson with McGovern in 72. It was the wrong lesson, but they learned the lesson that has been over and over again been taught, which is to say that in the American history, it never pays politically, it seems, to be anti-war. And they don't want to declare it.
And yet, you know, democracy is something I kind of like, really. I'd like to see more economic democracy, even. If there were democratic decision-making, not just in Congress, I know this is really crazy, but if it were up to the people to decide whether or not to make war, I bet we'd have a lot more people whose bodies would still be whole, quite frankly. And I think that, you know, the intent of having Congress there as a representative of the people, it was a good idea, and it's still a good idea. Banging the head against the wall. Yeah, it's sort of a small club we're in, Danny.
can I say one quick thing about that? I promise I'm brief, but it really has reached farcical and absurd levels, because you mentioned that if the people were, you know, kind of asked, we probably would end these wars, right? I mean, I think Trump's election was partly a symptom of that, but here's how crazy it's gotten. You want to talk about the definition of chicken hawk? The definition of a chicken hawk is someone who supports the continuation of wars presently, which are now, according to multiple recent polls, opposed by 7 out of 10 of military veterans and their dependent family members.
Wow.
That is the ultimate chicken hawk, to continue to support a war that is not only unpopular with the American civilian populace, but is actually slightly more unpopular with the combat veterans themselves. That's remarkable. And I can't actually think of a time in American history when that large, even in Vietnam, that large of a percentage of the veteran community was against the war. Maybe in like 71 or 72, but I don't know, even know if it was ever that high.
That is really very impressive. And, you know, you got to look to the military. The military is key to this whole thing, and certainly in so many different ways. I wonder, you know, quite frankly, if Trump loses, would it might be the military that has to go in and take him out, because he would resist, I wonder. And what would the military do? How, you know, if he's alienating the military like he seems to be doing with regard to firing that captain of the ship, whose name I can't recall, but I bet you have, you know, because he tried to protect his people from COVID by telling the truth. The military is still very, very important. And to hear from you that 7 out of 10 oppose that, that's interesting. And maybe that's one reason why the idea of privatizing everything is gaining strength. The Republicans would love to privatize Social Security and Medicare, among other things. And Betsy DeVos's brother, Eric Prinz, is lobbying for privatizing the whole Afghan war. Could the pandemic help leverage the role of private contractors and soldiers of fortune in future American war making? What about this, Danny?
Oh, absolutely. Well, first of all, they operate in smaller elements. Therefore, in a pandemic world, you know, presumably safer. There are less Americans among them because oftentimes they recruit not only Americans but also foreign forces or foreigners and foreign proxies.
Yeah.
And like we mentioned, you know, they do not raise the public consciousness because there aren't the flags very coffins. We don't recognize their deaths, you know, at sporting events. And they sort of like slip under the radar, these deaths. Now, they destroy communities and families still, right, or small, you know, kind of clans of people who still lose someone. But it doesn't have a public feel. And one of the beauties of, like, uber privatization, right, is that it does hide a lot of things from public view by dint of it being private. You know, this is really, really important. But one last thing about the military component, I will say, it's anecdotal but instructive. I have, over the years, more and more military folks on active duty, mind you, including former students, have been reaching out to me with massive, like, identity crises and ethical crises where they think about resigning or they're just saying, what do I do when I'm against this? I will tell you this. In the week since my Memorial Day article or the week and a half or whatever it's been now and my Jimmy Dore appearance and now, of course, with these protests, I will tell you, at a very conservative estimate, around 36 active duty troops, only a few of whom are students, most of whom I have no idea who they are, have reached out to me and expressed solidarity with protests, anti-war feelings, and many, many, many of them genuine ethical crises where they're thinking about resigning. This is a tidal wave. At least a tidal wave for me, and at the very least, it's a lot of rumblings and a lot of smoke. And something we have not seen in the last 20 years. And I bet you it's making folks nervous because there are few of them and there are many of us. But what the few rely on is the foot soldiers, whether they be police or soldiers. And when the daisy goes in the barrel and the soldier refuses to shoot in that famous moment, then it sort of exposes the few for what they are, few.
Fantastic. That was good description. Rather, you know, some degree of hope. We need hope these days. And you know, what we talk about post-pandemic warriors may not be uniformed soldiers, special or otherwise, or even human, perhaps. Barack Obama had used the drones pretty excessively, perhaps. He used them a lot to make wars and to keep from having to put boots on the ground in places like Afghanistan and so many other places. So, you know, it helps boost support for wars that, as you say, remain out of sight, out of mind. What about Venezuela? What's going on there? I mean, it seems to be the Trump administration seems, you know, to be drooling and just determined to overthrow the Maduro government. But they're not going to do it with conventional military means, I don't think. But what about privatized army? What do you see going on there with regard to Venezuela and Maduro?
Well, of course, Mike Pompeo's sort of comment that we had no direct role was instructive in itself, right? His head said a lot of things.
Yes.
The reality is these folks are being trained in Colombia. There's a lot of reporting in a variety of non-mainstream but very credible sources about it would be almost ridiculous to think the American government didn't at least have knowledge, foreknowledge of what was about to happen with this Silver Corp, you know, low-level kind of small mercenary companies, farcical coup. But I have said I think it would be a mistake, and in one article I wrote for the American Conservative, it would be a mistake to see what happened in Venezuela as simply farce. I actually think it's foreboding largely because, number one, it's of a piece with American history in the region where, you know, filibuster mercenaries have been at this since 1850. But it also is reflective of this new American way of war. I don't think the American people are going to accept an invasion of Venezuela. And I think even most of the Trump team knows this. So what do we do instead? Well, we wage a multifaceted sort of furtive and clandestine war, both, you know, with our government agencies like the DEA and the CIA and special forces, but also with the privatization and the mercenary element. I mean, but this all finally must be seen in the context of American, especially American modern policy in Latin America. So, for example, during the Bush years, the early Bush years, there's this attempted coup that actually was sort of embarrassing in 2002, I believe, in Venezuela against Chavez. Uh-huh. The paratroopers, right, actually come and save him, right, because he, and it makes him more popular. But what happens in the wake of that, we never learn, by the way, what happens in the wake of that is, I believe, 13 Latin American countries elect leftist-leaning and independent foreign policy governments between 2002 and 2009. Mm-hmm. But then in 2009, there's a military coup in Honduras, and there he is again. The polite Emperor Obama largely supports the military coup. Yeah. And then since then, there's been a counter, right, a counteroffensive of the right supported by Washington. And of course, the most ridiculous and powerful and dangerous is Bolsonaro in Brazil. So I think we'd like to see something similar with Guaido. But of course, the problem is Guaido is loathed by the vast majority of the Venezuelan people.
Again, it's just, you know, hello, Vietnam. You know, we put our guys in there that the people didn't like. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. But among the lines, you know, of the privatized armies and the small brushfire wars, you talk about tiny teams abroad. You refer to Army Special Forces A teams. What are they, and what ways might they be building blocks for new American version of post-pandemic warfare?
Right. So the A team is, you know, famous because of Mr. T in the 80s, right, the show. But the A team is a real thing. It's Special Forces Detachment Alpha. And so, you know, these are the building blocks of, you know, American advisory and proxy warfare. Many times when it was politically unpopular for there to be a massive American military invasion and occupation, again, back to Central America and many other places, specifically in Africa, what we do instead is we take the Special Forces A team of 12 men commanded by a captain, assistant commanded by a warrant officer, and then all, like, mostly pretty senior NCOs. And what we do is we use them either to train our proxy guerrillas or to buck up the security forces of often corrupt sort of rightist regimes. And so what reason they are perfect building blocks, and I don't have special expertise in the special force community, but I understand it pretty well, is, you know, they all have their own specialty. So there's kind of like an explosives guy and a medical guy and a weapons guy and an intelligence guy, right? They have special specifications, each of these 12 guys. And then what they do is they advise and build up larger forces, even like a battalion, you know, so you might have a special force unit 12 that's training a battalion, or they may even be stationed in a brigade headquarters of, say, 2,000 local security forces. And so they sort of find a way to do America's bidding, right, through the use of these proxies. But very little thought is ever given, and especially no accountability to the legitimacy and popularity of these forces or to their human rights record. And we are easily able to wash our hands of it, because what we do is we say, well, we didn't train them to kill those civilians. They just did it. It's not our fault. Mm. And then we lie about whether our brain braves were actually near the front or not, mm-hmm. because in many cases they are pretty close to the front. And there was lots of lying about this, of course, for example, back to El Salvador, which is becoming even more relevant in my mind recently.
Oh, great. Well, I'm interested in hearing more about this. You say, quote, COVID-19 may prove the death knell of American war as classically imagined, end quote. At first blush, this does sound hopeful, but how might it serve to ramp up other war-making techniques?
So there is a chance, right, that in 5 years we will look back or whatever number and say that the pandemic was somehow pivotal. And I think we will read back a truth that maybe didn't exactly exist, because this evolution towards proxy war and social distance war has been going on for some time now, again, since the second Obama term. But, you know, if we reach a point, right, the logical conclusion of the way this American war by abstraction is going, and we reach a point where maybe only one or two or maybe even zero Americans die overseas, it will be relatively easy for either a Democratic or even a Trump administration to say, I ended these wars. Americans aren't dying anymore. You don't really even know how many folks are going. We're not sending brigades that, you know, get into the local newspaper in Colorado Springs and 5,000 folks deploy. And so there's the chance that these wars that are real killing on the business end of an American bomb or commando air raid that he called in, those wars may become even more invisible than they already are. Mm. So there's a political calculus where you can say, look, I ended wars. Wars as you think of war, when you think of D-Day, those are over. But it doesn't mean that American policy, American strategy and methods are not still killing, you know, up into the hundreds of thousands, and if you count since 9/11, you know, 2-3 million folks. And so this is this to me is not only absurd, but it is ethically obscene and really shakes what it means to be a democracy or a republic to its foundation, especially because it's invisible.
Invisible, yes, indeed. Now, I just one more thing. The rage that erupted when Trump threatened to use military against us. Senator Tom Cotton, I believe, of Kansas? No, Arkansas, maybe. I don't know. I don't like him.
Arkansas.
Yeah, Arkansas. Was all in favor of that. And maybe now is a time when you hear talk of this that people can imagine what it's like for people all over the world to have American troops coming in, taking over their town and you know, clearing them out with gas and real bullets. So let's turn now to the increased pressure on the military from Trump on domestic warmaking. As you say, so now we brace for the army in American streets. And I note Mark Esper said he does not support invoking a law that would allow Trump to do that and surrounding the death of George Floyd. We've seen frightening pictures of what appear to be the military in full war-making gear surrounding the Lincoln Monument, for example. People in the military are Americans. They're not drones. They're not robots. They're humans. What is your sense of whether or not military personnel would attack fellow American citizens if so ordered? Tough question, I know.
I want to believe that the majority would not, but one must remember that one of the sort of diseases of militarism is that loyalty is often prized over ethics or the republic, and that's not how it's designed, but it's the nature of brotherhood and unit pride and all these things that we foster. I fear that they would. Okay, ultimately, large elements of the American military would open fire on their own citizens. And the fact that this is a volunteer force makes it, I think, more likely than it was with a draftee force. However, we are seeing one of my organizations that I've been speaking for recently, About Face Veterans Against the War, allied with Veterans Peace, I'm a member of both, has called for a stand down order for the National Guard. And of course, we would extend that even more so to the active duty, saying you do not have to do this. You know, stand down for Black lives, do not fire on your own citizens, march with them, all this. There are rumblings, and there are already cases of people refusing orders. So there is hope, maybe not optimism, but hope. The thing to remember is, you mentioned, you know, American soldiers have been policing the cities in a scary way of a broad swath of the world from West Africa to Central Asia for 20 years now.
Yeah.
I think it would be a eye-opening thing for the 82nd Airborne or similar active forces to be in American cities. And I'm a film geek, Bert, so I'm just going to just read one quick quote. Do you remember the movie The Siege from 1998 with Denzel Washington and Bruce Willis?
I haven't seen it.
So this is a prescient movie about a terrorist attack in Brooklyn, and then martial law is, and it's, you know, 3 years before 9/11, martial law is declared, right? And it's very interesting, but the general who ends up becoming a war criminal, Bruce Willis's character, he actually warns against using the army to the Senate at first. And he says, the army is a broadsword, not a scalpel. Trust me, Senator, you do not want the army in an American city. And then finally, he ends with saying, you know, what would happen if you did it? He said, 12 hours after the president gives the order, we can be on the ground. One light infantry division, right? 10,700 men, helicopters, tanks. And of course, the ubiquitous M16A1 assault rifle, a humble enough weapon until you see it in the hands of a man outside your local bowling alley or 7-Eleven. And I think that is an important moment where fiction is almost truer, right, than fact on the ground. And we should be very, very, very scared of the invocation of the Insurrection Act at such a low threshold, not to minimize the violence, not to minimize looting, or to say it's okay. But if you are going to put the Insurrection Act of 1807, already archaic, at such a low threshold as to bring active duty troops to our streets, this is an enormously, existentially dangerous thing for the republic.
You mentioned a group of veterans who are concerned about this and who are fighting that. Could you just say the name of that? Maybe people might want to help them out. And any other places you might suggest that people support?
Absolutely. So About Face, Veterans Against the War is the full title. We used to be known as the Iraq Veterans Against the War, have linked up largely with the even larger, older peace organization of veterans, Veterans for Peace, for, you know, a stand down order. You can find websites for both. You can find the open letter that we put out, the stand down to the National Guard order from About Face. We are working directly with the GI Rights Hotline. We are not forcing people to take these personal risks. We are encouraging them and trying to support them if they do. And there are positive outcomes already happening among these National Guard and potentially active duty soldiers.
This is certainly an interesting time. Major Danny Searson, thanks so much for coming back on this show. His new book coming out this fall, Patriotic Descent, America in the Age of Endless War. Thank you so much for being with us and for a little bit of optimism. Thank you.
Thank you, Bert. I'm always glad to do it and hope we can do it again soon.
You will. Thanks.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks. Well, I just want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. Put a gun in my hands and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther as the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A war can be won, you want me to believe. But I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain. Like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fastened all the triggers for the others to fire. Then you sit back and watch as the death count gets high. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. And you've thrown the worst fear that can never be heard. Fear to bring children into the world, for threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. Well, you ain't worth blood that runs in your veins. Well, how much do I know? Do talk out of turn. You might say that I'm young, you might say I'm unlearned. But there's one thing I know, though I'm younger than you. But even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? Well, I think you will find, when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back a soul. And I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. And I'll follow your casket in the pale afternoon. And I'll watch as you're lowered down to your deathbed. And I'll stand over your grave to make sure that you're dead.